You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on December 14th, 2012, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here in London, and you're listening to Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Tyler Burleigh. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, Colombia is expected to grow by 4.5% next year. So what exactly has the country done so right? We ask the country's president, Juan Manuel Santos.
We have identified what we have called the engines for growth, and we have stimulated those engines, and we have a plan for investment in the country, for example, in infrastructure, and that also stimulates growth.
Now, there's a bit of a scoop for you, and with some European leaders urging Mario Monti to stay in office for just a little bit longer, we'll ask if cheerleading from abroad is ever a good thing. We'll also pop by one of our neighbors. This time we venture out from our Tokyo bureau and pop into a stationery store.
We have two original main types of paper. Our contracted paper mill sits at the foot of Mount Fuji, and a plentiful supply of pure mountain water makes soft and beautiful paper.
And the city of Casablanca has just opened its first light rail line. We'll ask the man in charge of Zurich's trams how a city can ever survive without one. And Damien Hirst has just exited his 17-year relationship with the Gagosian Gallery. Our culture editor, Rob Bound, will be here to tell us what's next for one of the world's richest artists. And later in the show, our editor, Andrew Tuck, and foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, will be here to tell us what happened over the course of the week. Gentlemen, what happened? Very quickly.
It was rockets, Syrian Scud rockets I'll be talking about.
And I'll be talking about the North Koreans who finally managed to get one up and in orbit as well.
Excellent. All that and much more right here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And good evening from a very blustery London. It is just 2 minutes past six on a Friday evening. That normally means it's time to go over to Mr. Spencer with the news.
A number of people have been killed in a shooting at a primary school in Connecticut. The gunman is said to be amongst the dead after the attack in Newtown. The incident happened at 9:40 a.m. local time. It's thought police have recovered two weapons. Rival demonstrators have clashed in Alexandria as Egypt prepares for the referendum on the draft constitution. 19 people are said to have been injured as opponents and supporters of President Morsi clashed. The United States has agreed to deploy two Patriot missile batteries in Turkey, along with 400 personnel to operate them. Turkey asked NATO for the missiles after a series of rockets from Syria landed in Turkish territory. US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta confirmed the deployment on a visit to the country today.
We are deploying two Patriot batteries here to Turkey, along with the troops that are necessary to man those batteries, so that we can help Turkey have the kind of missile defense it may very well need in dealing with threats that come out of Syria.
A two-day summit of European leaders in Brussels has seen agreement to press on with further integration. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the steps go beyond the deal on centralizing banking supervision, but she concluded the event with a note of warning, saying tough times lie ahead for Europe. 2 days ahead of the parliamentary election in Japan, a poll shows at least a third of voters are still undecided. There are predictions that the Conservative Liberal Democratic Party will secure an impressive victory, but there has been general dissatisfaction amongst voters with all the main political parties. Political analyst Professor Koichi Nakano is concerned that the LDP will win because of people supporting them for the wrong reasons.
I find little enthusiasm among the people for the LDP. So it's if that outcome is actually produced, you'll be more likely because of the popular desire to punish the DPJ and voting for the LDP because it's the alternative.
Doctors treating former South African President Nelson Mandela say they're satisfied with his condition. It's almost a week since he was hospitalised with a lung infection. Johannesburg residents have been wishing him a speedy recovery.
I'd like to wish Dr. Mandela well and hope that he recovers fully from his infliction that he has now.
I'm just wishing Baba Mandela a speedy recovery The whole of Africa really needs him, and we appreciate everything he has done. And we're looking forward to him coming out soon.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks for that, David. More from you in about 25 minutes time. It is 19:05 in Rome, 18:05 here in London, 13:05 if you're listening in Washington, D.C.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, politicians are arch power brokers, but it's rare that they seek to influence the domestic politics of other nations. However, in this crisis-riddled European Union that we live in, premiers are weighing in on their neighbours' national agendas. This is especially true in the case of Italy. There's a realisation that the country's stability could make or break a Eurozone recovery, and Europe's leaders are throwing their weight behind the man they think can steer the country away from fiscal collapse. Earlier this week, German leader Angela Merkel said she supported the reforms launched by Mario Monti's government and said she hoped that the Italian people would stick with him. Yesterday, at the summit of European finance ministers, the company made it clear they too favoured the unelected technocrat Mario Monti rather than the predecessor Silvio Berlusconi. Well, to discuss the implications of this international support for Monti and to talk about the theme of meddling in other people's politics, we're joined on the line by Gianni Riotta, former editor and chief of Il Sole 24, and of course, a regular contributor to Monocle 24. He's on the line from Milan. Buonasera, Mr. I was going to say Mr. Monti, Mr. Riotta.
Buonasera.
Tell me, how is this playing out in Italy right now? I mean, when you get the likes of Chancellor Merkel, giving this endorsement across the border, and certainly what we saw, also from European finance ministers, how are the papers reporting it?
It's a double-edged sword, Taylor, because people that support Monti see this endorsement like lighting in the dark. They hope that it will guide them to victory in February, March, and convince President Monti to run in the coming elections. A lot of people do not like the Germans to meddle with Italian politics. We've been clashing with them for the past 2,000 years. And so a lot of people really react with a lot of anger to that. Eventually, people will be excited by Europe supporting Monti, and the same amount of people will be angered. So I don't think that will have actually an effect on the political situation in Italy comes February.
Mm. It's been interesting to see how some corners of Italy have been reacting to the news that Mr. Berlusconi might return to the political stage and, of course, seek the leadership again. Tell me about Italy Incorporated. When you look at the major companies, but let's say also really the backbone of Italian business, the Italian Mittelstand, the small, very important family businesses. Where do they sit, Monti versus Berlusconi, do you think?
If you want to go broadly across the canvas, I would say that the old money, the big companies, the global companies, do back Mario Monti. The medium-sized companies, the mom and pops, may be tempted to side with Berlusconi and the tax-dodging culture that is in that party. But please keep an eye on the huge convention that has been scheduled for Sunday in Rome, where a lot of officials, elected officials in the Berlusconi, Forza Italia, and then PDL, Paris will convene, and many of them can come out of the closet and eventually support Monti. So it's a huge event Sunday, and Berlusconi is frantically trying to convince them to stay with him, but I'm positive that a few of them will jump ship and try to convince Monti to run, because up to now we don't have a positive yes on Mario Monti. We're still waiting for him to say yes, I will run.
And if we end up getting a no, who is there to step into to Monty's shoes?
Nobody. Nobody, because the Democratic Party, the left, the socialist, the former socialist led by Mr. Bersani, they are credited in the polls with 30% of the votes, 32% of the votes, and they may go up to 40% thanks to the electoral law, and they want to run and win and then do some sort of alliance with the center led by Mr. Cassini. Monti is unique. Montezemolo, Ferrari is tempted to run himself or with some surrogate. There are other people that are trying the waters, but there is only one Mario Monti. That's why he was called by President Napolitano to run government last year.
And just to be clear, we're talking, if it is Montezemolo, we're talking about Papa, not Junior, right?
Absolutely. It's Luca Cordero di Montezemolo. He was former Gianni Agnelli's Fiat protégé and now is chairman of Ferrari. It is run successful for many, many years. He has a kid that runs other companies, but we are talking about Montezemolo's father.
Yeah. Now, just you've been watching this game for a while, rather familiar with it, Gianni. So if you're a bit of a betting man, do you think that Monti, in the end, will be persuaded to stay?
I'll be honest with you. Monti was a columnist of Corriere della Sera. I was deputy editor of Corriere della Sera. I edited his columns for years. He's a good friend. And the Monti I used to know would not have run. I mean, the Monti I used to know, my answer would be like, no, he won't run. Now is a different Monti because he feels that Berlusconi cheated on him because they had a pact that they would end up the go with the government and arrive to the normal date of the elections. And he did nothing against Berlusconi in particular or his business. So he feels that Berlusconi broke his promises, and so he feels that he has now free hands to act. So the old Monti, the answer is no, he won't run. The new Monti, he may run. I have like a little bit of a contrarian view because a lot of my friends, columnists, and you know the usual pundits, the usual suspect, are convinced that when Mario says I'll run, and Italians are getting up in arms and say Super Mario, I'm not positive with that. I think that Monti will add to the center a modicum amount of votes, but I don't think that he will be the decisive player in the coming election.
You heard it here first. That was Gianni Riotta, editor, writer, and regular contributor to Monocle 24. Thanks very much for that. Coming up, with news that Casablanca is getting its first light rail line, we'll ask, how does a tram change a city? That's next.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian Lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
and you are listening to Midori House. It is just 18:15 here in London. Now, thousands of city trains and trams run up and down the capitals of Europe each day, but increasingly, it's locales far from the Bahnhofstrasse that are welcoming in light rail lines. This week, Morocco's King Mohammed attended a ceremony to inaugurate the first light rail line in Casablanca. The 31-kilometre line will run through the city's main neighbourhoods, the French-made cars making 48 stops along the way. So how do trams transform the urban fabric of a city? Well, two people who know a lot about this are our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, and of course, the chief of Zurich's tram system, Andreas Uhl. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Mr. Uhl, I wanted to start with you. We're no strangers to Zurich. Our headquarters are in that city. We're local taxpayers. We help keeping the trams ticking along. How central is Zurich's tram to the city's identity, would you say?
You have to see trams, light rail vehicles are the gold standard in public transport. It's the commitment bring people aloft and cars go away in the city centre. Less pollution, less traffic jam, more space for people. That's the paradigm.
Mm. I mean, how much does that come through also legislation? Of course, a city and a local government, Mr. Uhl, can lay down tracks. But then, of course, there can be other things that, of course, can play into the mix to, of course, curb vehicles from being used as well. But is there something about the tram that also seduces passengers, that that really excites and delights the local community, that they also want to ride on these vehicles? Is there something also almost natural about the process?
I can confirm that without hesitation. You need some political decisions to bring back light rail vehicles. You have to reduce the cars in the city centre, and that's a huge political power you need in the first time. But when you have this light rail vehicle, you have a city centre, less pollution, less noise, more space, more trees. You can do a lot, and we see it when there are surveys about the standard of living. When they compare all the cities worldwide, Zurich is number one or number two in every survey, and it has directly to do with the light rail vehicles in the city of Zurich.
Mm. I want to bring in our transport editor, Tristan McAllister. Tristan, tell me, you have a little bit of experience with this in a particular city on the U.S. West Coast.
Yes, of course. Portland, Oregon is a pretty good example of this. For starters, it really sort of recentered its urban core based on a light rail or tram system. And the city got on board, local businesses got on board, and what you saw was that it transformed an area which was full of warehouses, full of places that people didn't really want to be. You know, my family's got a lot of history, actually, in Portland, Oregon. That was a place that when my parents were kids, they never went to, because it was industrial, and then it went through a time where it just wasn't safe. But that perception completely changed, and a lot of people say that the light rail or the tram became the reason for the increase in rents, the increase in investor confidence in the area, a reduction in crime. So, you know, on a lot of touch points, light rail and tram really do a lot for cities.
Mm. Mr. Uhl, could you tell me, what does the government in Casablanca, what will they have to do? I mean, you mentioned, of course, that there should be curbs. I mean, you can't just put the tracks down alone to hope that there's going to be change. So what measures would you say, what would the top three measures be for Casablanca's local rulers to make sure that this works and is adopted by the local community and I guess visitors as well?
First and foremost, you have to bring in some subsidies for this system. Government must bring some tax money that the prices are quite low. That's the first factor. Then you must be very reliable, fast and reliable, that you have a competitive advantage against the car. And
you have to do a clever marketing, that you bring the elite of your society, bank directors, engineers, lawyers, and so on, that you bring them in this system. That's a key factor of success.
Tristan, any sense of what they had to do in Portland? Because, of course, we know it's rather difficult to pry Americans from their vehicles, particularly of the four-wheel type.
I think what they did, a big part of it, was they instituted something that they called a fareless square area, which they, most of the downtown core, it's free to ride the public transportation. You go beyond that, and of course you have to pay money, but it really made it so you didn't need a car to be in downtown Portland. You could get to restaurants, you could get to businesses, you could get to the spaces where you lived or worked, and there was no need to drive a car. And, you know, parking is at a premium in most urban areas, and I think a lot of people thought, well, I don't really want to pay for parking, and I don't want to deal with the hassle, period. And the streetcar seems a really good alternative.
Would you say, I guess, you've spent time in that city. Did you even notice a spike in Portland, just ridership, and without even looking at hard figures, just how people really adopted and really sort of, you know, took it on as part of their own, as part of the city?
Yes, of course. I think people really embraced it. I think that's a big part of it, too, in these places that people really need to be on board with it. Everyone looked forward to it. I think one of the precursors to it was a pretty significant suburban light rail system that had been very successful, that had taken many awards nationally and internationally for what it had done as far as connecting the airport to the city center and to other suburbs. And I think the confidence was there. And then when you put it in the context of a downtown area and letting people get around easily, I think there was no reason to doubt it.
Mm. Gentlemen, just before we go, and Mr. Uhl, I'll just ask you first. If you look at Zurich right now, compared to a lot of discussion we hear about other cities, you know, many talk about the role of buses, and buses with dedicated lines are a much cheaper way to go. But what happens when you actually fix rails, within a street as well? I'm wondering what happens with the discipline and the traffic hierarchy. Is there something a little bit different about dedicated bus lanes versus putting hard steel between the pavement?
It's a psychological factor, I think. When you have investors in real estate, when you have the steel in the street, they know for a century there is light rail vehicle. When you have only a bus line, you can change it immediately, and then you have a stranded investment. That gave a huge investment in these streets in Zurich, where we built some new rail lines.
Excellent. I am going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. Mr. Andreas Uhl, head of Zurich's tram system. Our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, in New York. Gentlemen, thanks very much. It is just 23 minutes past the hour here in London. You are listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. And you are back with me, Tyler Brulé. And you're also with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and our editor, Andrew Tuck. And because it's Friday, what happens now?
We look back over the week that was.
That's good. Now, I don't want you to bump into the table, Steve, because that particular bottle, that bottle of grape juice that you have sitting there in front of you, I don't want it to go tumbling. I think just hold on to it.
I'll hold on to it.
Yeah, that's
good.
I'll
hold on to it.
Excellent. News-wise, what stands out for you? I know there was a bit of a scramble because we've been not creating our own news, but we have a couple of, we're busy. Everyone's busy at this time of year. But if you had to look back across the last 7 days.
Well, as I mentioned.
Oh, Andrew, why don't you go first? Steve.
That's confusing.
No, I know.
Well,
Steve.
Why look at me, but ask Steve to
listen,
respond.
I just woke up from a nap, so.
Okay. Well, I'm sharp.
Okay, tell me.
The new Rocket Man in Pyongyang.
Yes.
This is a successful attempt. Well, not really, it's not an attempt if it's successful, is it? But anyway, this is the North Koreans, their rocket testing, getting a rocket that put a satellite up into orbit. But everyone's more concerned that this is, again, a way of testing Well, testing missiles, but also testing the sensibilities of their neighbours. And I think everybody was very concerned. The South Koreans were very concerned and claimed they might have shot it down if it had gone over their territory. The Japanese were very upset. The Chinese said that they weren't very happy as well. They were concerned about it.
Mm.
So it's kind of riled lots of people in the neighbourhood. But it's his father's old tricks of pushing a little bit further again and again to see what the consequences are and to see whether you can get more aid out of people, you can get more food aid. But what was interesting for me was that the pictures that they released of him watching the rocket launch. There's one of him kind of having a crafty fag, sitting in a kind of a very empty room, which looks like some kind of really kind of sleazy kind of hotel room. It's got kind of like green velour sofas in the background.
It may well.
Do you think that they looked at the photos of Obama, Hillary Clinton and the rest of the US national security team when bin Laden was killed and thought, we should do something like
this
that as well.
This is,
this is what we need to do.
Yeah, it could have been. I have a feeling that there is better. There's better stage management than ever before going on in Pyongyang. Steve, do you have a rocket in your arsenal?
Yes. So Scud missiles made a return.
Not as big as Andrew's rocket just now.
No, and not a very accurate return because Scud missiles aren't very accurate. But it's another sign of Bashar al-Assad's increasing desperation in Syria that he would start using Scud missiles, not chemical weapons, which some in the West, particularly the US and the UK, have been hyping up as if it's a reality, as if he's definitely going to do it. So that's the big sort of the military issue within Syria this week. But far more important, I think, was actually what was happening in Marrakesh with the Friends of Syria meeting, where the US the day before said, well, we're not in favour of all members of the Syrian opposition because one or two of you we think have slight terrorist leanings. However, within 24 hours, we will back the new Syrian National Council. It's an interesting move. It's certainly a more pluralistic group than the one that existed before. It's not just Sunni dominated, and it has actually people on the ground in Syria itself. And you know, it was a big week then for Mars al-Khatib, who's the new head of that opposition group, to see whether he can really keep that group together.
And interesting, I was just saying, interesting, Moscow as well saying this week for the first time that actually there could be regime change actually in Syria.
We were talking to Shashank Joshi earlier in the week. We talk to Shashank Joshi almost every day, who's one of our Middle East analysts. And I was asking him about the use of Scuds. You know, how much is this an act of a desperate man? I throw this out to both of you. Versus also, how much of it is for international media consumption as well? Do you think both are weighed up or no? Here's something which is sitting in our arsenal, let's just use it. How this plays out on the world stage, you know, is an afterthought.
I think it's more of an afterthought, yes. I think at the moment, for him, it's all about survival. And if he thinks that Scuds are going to help, then he will use that. When it comes to how those actions are viewed by the rest of the world, I mean, to be honest, I think he'd rather the rest of the world just completely ignored what was happening in Syria.
Mm.
And he could get on with it, as other despots have been able to get on with killing their own people in the past. We've not always been against people, presidents killing their own people. So I think he would rather that we all just ignored it.
And did you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And I was just going to say, it's been a fascinating thing that it's a full year. Many of the people who have been in the refugee camps now across the borders in Turkey. This has been going on for an incredibly long time. And when you look at the snapshots of, you know, what happened in Egypt, well, there's still consequences, but the overthrow part was so swift.
It was 18 days.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah. We feel that it should be happening the same. And even those stories reverberate. It was interesting to see today that the French have seized, the Spanish have seized rather, I think, €27 million worth of property belonging to Mubarak in Spain. Everything from villas in Marbella to houses in Madrid. And these stories are going to unfold for a long time. But in Syria, it just seems so painful, the whole process, so drawn out and so unclear even now where it will actually end.
And I think just on that note, it's very easy for analysts to say, Assad's regime is doomed. It's just a matter of time. And, well, yes, maybe it is doomed and it is just a matter of time. But frankly, we don't know.
Mm.
You know, we could be here in a year's time talking about how, you know, Assad has clung on, because the big thing, you know, here is, you know, there is no overwhelming popular uprising as there was in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya. And frankly, the West is not going to come in guns blazing.
Mm. Look through the studio glass over there. So you've got a massive audience. I think people like to come down and actually watch this live. We should be selling tickets for this. Andrew, okay, rockets aside, anything else? I'll give you one more story this week.
Well, in fact, you know, it's not a story that we'd normally cover, but...
the monkey in IKEA in Toronto. Okay. That was one that we really... I mean, we have a new bureau there.
We missed that, didn't we?
We were not on that story.
We should have gone.
I don't know if it's because Tom
monkey.
Edwards has been away, Stephen. You've been looking after
no,
the lineup.
Steady but, on, no.
Well, I don't know. I just, you know, I thought we could have been live from IKEA, you know, monkey analysts on, etc.
Okay, I accept we missed a trick there. Right.
Well, I guess the other story we have to raise, which is more a Steve story, is the Susan Rice story, which we've been talking about a little bit today as well. But, you know, it's just interesting, you know, that she pulled out. And it pulled out part because of media coverage. You know, she knew that there would be too much debate, too much noise. It would cause too much of a stink that she just couldn't, you know, dare kind of try and go ahead.
And she may, well, she's going to stick around. She'll remain as UN US ambassador to the UN. And I wouldn't be surprised if within 12 months she's also national security advisor to Obama, because that's something that doesn't need Senate approval. And, you know, Obama still really rates her. She has been with him since before the start. So back in 2007, when he first started thinking about running, she was his main foreign policy advisor. I'm sure she will continue in that role officially or unofficially.
And just before we go, who takes over Hillary's 757? Who's going to be running around doing Boeing shuttle diplomacy?
I'll be shocked if it's not John Kerry.
Mm. Okay, well, you heard it here. Probably not first, but anyway, you heard it here nonetheless.
It here.
Gentlemen, Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, Andrew Tuck, your editor.
Don't you? Worry about my...
No, I keep on... I just keep on... I sometimes want to call you editor-in-chief, but that's me. that's it. We're going to go for a short break, but we're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's 18:32 here at Midori House. So coming up over the next 28 minutes, we'll ask Colombia's president how his country is growing in a global recession, see why Damien Hirst has left his perch with Gagosian, and we'll visit a stationery shop near our bureau in Tokyo. But first, Mr. David Spencer is back with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thank you. As many as 27 people have been killed in a shooting at a primary school in Connecticut. The gunman is amongst the dead. The incident happened in Newtown at 9:40 a.m. local time. Rival demonstrators have clashed in Alexandria as Egypt prepares for the referendum on the draft constitution. 19 people are said to have been injured in violence between opponents and supporters of President Morsi. The United States has agreed to deploy two Patriot missile batteries in Turkey, along with 400 personnel, to operate them. Turkey asked NATO for the missiles after a series of rockets from Syria landed in Turkish territory. A two-day summit of European leaders in Brussels has seen agreement to press on with further integration. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the steps go beyond the deal on centralising banking supervision. Doctors treating former South African President Nelson Mandela say they're satisfied with his condition. He was hospitalised with a lung infection on Saturday. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, David. You are listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24. Well, when Juan Manuel Santos was elected president of Colombia 2 years ago, he ran with the full support of his predecessor, Alvaro Uribe. Santos has continued many of the same policies, cracking down on FARC, improving security and growing the economy. But he's also gone his own way, focusing on the fight against poverty and inequality with far more vigor. His vision of Colombia is kinder, gentler and perhaps happier. As he weighs up his chances of re-election in 18 months' time, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who was just here, spoke to President Santos a little bit earlier about the failed war on drugs, the booming economy and his now frosty relationship with Uribe. Steve began by asking the president what Colombia is getting right at the moment.
It's a combination of different factors. I think we have put in place the correct policies. We have identified what we have called the engines for growth, and we have stimulated those engines. We have a very prudent fiscal and monetary policy. We are promoting our exports aggressively, and we have a plan for investment in the country, for example, in infrastructure, which is unprecedented, and that also stimulates growth. So it's a combination of factors that made our economy a very dynamic economy.
And what is it that you think has changed over the last two decades? Because, you know, the story of Colombia 20 years ago was not a great one. You had, you know, a series of very big problems to do with drugs, to do with the FARC and security. How has that turned around, do you think, over the last two decades?
Well, the first thing where we concentrated is in the security of the country. As you very well mentioned, we were a failed state. That was what many of the academics called us, a failed state.
And do you think that was accurate? I mean, would you have described that? Looking back now,
I think we had a failed state is where the state cannot really perform its duties. And in about a third or half of the country, that was true some 12 years ago. The first thing we did was to take control of our country. For example, we have 1,100 municipalities. Out of those, 400, the mayors of those municipalities were not able to be in their towns addressing the needs of the people because of security problems. That has changed dramatically, 180% degrees. It's a completely different situation. Today, we have complete control of every centimeter of our territory. We have defeated the drug cartels. The drug lords are all dead or in jail. In our fight against the guerrillas, we have performed extremely well. They are weakened. They are back in the very remote areas. And at this very moment, we are discussing with them to see how they can lay down their arms and become part of our civil society. So in terms of security, we have changed the country completely. And besides that, we have put in place a very aggressive social policy in my government, attacking extreme poverty and especially attacking inequality, because I think for a country to be sustainable in the long run, you need social justice and you need a country to be much more equitable than what we are right now. So we are addressing that problem. We have advanced a lot, but we still have a long way to go.
On that point of attacking poverty and inequality, they weren't necessarily the sorts of words that one would have necessarily heard from your predecessor, Álvaro Uribe. Do you think that there's, you know, you worked for him, you were his defense minister for some time. Have you tried to take the country in a different path, do you think, over the last 2 years?
Yes, in that respect, we have been much more aggressive in our social policy. We are concentrating a lot more of our budget in the social projects, and we have proved in Congress some very progressive and modern reforms addressing the inequality and addressing poverty. And in that respect, there is a difference with my predecessor. But at the same time, we have continued the policy on security, because we know that this is the basis for the progress of the country. I was Minister of Defense of President Uribe, so I simply continued what we put in place.
Now, you mentioned you continued a lot of what was in place. Your predecessor, though, hasn't necessarily been that grateful towards you for what you've done. He's been very critical of you on Twitter, despite the fact that a number of these policies are quite similar. Why do you think he's been doing that?
Well, he says that I betrayed him because I named some ministers that he didn't like, and because I fixed our relations with our neighbors, with Venezuela, with Ecuador, with whom he had very bad relations, but that was my duty. I'm the president, and usually presidents don't like when people who replace them change the policies. I changed the policies in that respect, and I brought in people who were not only enemies or rivals of my predecessor, but rivals of myself, because what I did is form a government of national unity. I followed the example of Abraham Lincoln, so I brought into the government the people who ran against me during the campaign. But if you want to unite the country, you must do that.
Now, one other thing that you've made quite clear over the last few months, and in fact we've covered this in the magazine as well, is that you believe that the war on drugs has been an absolute failure. Now, the US has bankrolled an enormous amount of that war on drugs, particularly with Plan Colombia. I mean, what discussions have you had with President Obama about what to do next? Because it's all very well you saying, well, I don't think we should go down this path, but if America's the ones with the money to spend, you need to bring them on board too, don't you?
Yes, I think there's a growing concern regarding the war on drugs and what we have done during the last 40 years. Colombia has been relatively successful because we put in place a policy that addressed each link of the chain in the drug trafficking business, and we specialized on each link, and we were relatively successful. For example, we dismantled the big drug cartels. We have seized increasing and huge amounts of cocaine. We have destroyed thousands and thousands of laboratories. We have put in jail many of the operators. We have reduced the amount of hectares dedicated to the cultivation of the coca leaf by 60-70%. However, the business still continues. And what we have done so far in Colombia, at least, has been relatively successful, but we are the first ones to recognize that the business will continue and the violence will continue as long as we continue with the same policies.
But how hopeful are you that President Obama, who, back when he was not even a senator, just 8 years ago, referred to the war on drugs and said it had utterly failed, words he won't use right now, how confident are you that you can persuade him that he was right 8 years ago and that you're right now?
That also depends on public opinion. What I see in the United States is an increasing recognition of the fact that the war on drugs needs to be readdressed, and even the fact that in the last elections in two states the use of marijuana was legalized by a popular vote. Well, this is a demonstration that we need to address this problem. It's completely contradictory if you put a peasant in Colombia in jail because he grows a plant of marijuana, and somebody in the U.S. can smoke the marijuana legally. This is a major and basic contradiction that the world has to address.
And just finally, we're about 18 months away from another presidential election in Colombia, so it's still a little bit of time to work out what you want to do next. You're able to run for a second term if you so choose. Are you going to?
Well, I've said I'm not going to address this issue until middle of next year. I don't want to raise expectations, and I want to finish my first term with my promises fulfilled. I have many things still to do. We have progressed tremendously in the last 28 months that we've been in government. I think the record and the indicators are very, very good. People say they're spectacular, but we still have much to do. And I will think about re-election probably the second semester of next year.
And that was the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment with a little song.
Christmas is coming to Monocle 24. Join our section editors as they look back on an eventful 2012 in affairs, business, culture, design, and everything else besides. They'll be joined by a host of specially invited guests to consider what the new year holds in store. That's every day at 7 a.m. London time, starting on Christmas Eve, right here on Monocle 24.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
We'll be right back.
and welcome back to Midori House. It is 1844 in London. I was trying to think of a song that maybe we could play that tied in with our interview with the President of Colombia, but I couldn't come up with anything. And then I was thinking, you know, there's no songs about the FARC or anything like that. So I'm not going to do that. I want to go back, rewind one story, maybe two stories, and our little piece that we had earlier about Casablanca getting its new tram system. So here's Judy Garland with the trolley song. Ding, ding.
I didn't know you knew all the moves as well as all the words.
It's good. I know. I'm glad I'm tethered back to my headphones again. That is a good song.
That's
isn't
a beautiful
it?
Song.
Our culture to Rob Bound, who had to come in early just to enjoy it. It was good. I was worried at the beginning. I remember that song with more of sort of a hard start with Judy Garland coming in. I didn't recall the chorus having a good sort of 1 minute lead in.
That's kind of like the 12-inch single, wasn't it? It was kind of the extended mix with lots of chorus.
That was from Meet Me in St. Louis.
That was lovely. And that's a proper Christmas song. We're getting into the spirit.
It was. As you said, it was rather technicolor, didn't you?
Yeah, it feels like it was. You know what that looks like. You just know that that's sort of got that lovely coloured in colour on it. Right?
Yeah, it does.
A bit too colourful.
Yeah, something that would be on probably about 4 o'clock on Christmas Day.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
It may well be. Now
you have to get the DVD though.
Now we're supposed to be. We are supposed to be talking about a bit of a divorce in the art world.
Yeah, so today it was announced by the Gagosian Gallery and by Science, who are Damien Hirst's well, production company, his sort of art-making company, that Gagosian and he are parting ways after 17 years.
Who got the press release out first, Ron?
I don't know. Well, I think actually Gagosian did. Mm. And I think Damien then just sort of said, yep, that's right. Whoops, I should have got that out first, maybe. But I don't know whether there's a huge. I don't know if there's a huge rush to get out the press release first. But it's an interesting thing. After 17 years, he seems to be focusing on secondary market and maybe boosting the price of things he's already made, and also presumably only putting his new works with Jay Jopling in the White Cube Gallery, which come out of London. But very importantly for Damien Hirst and his. Only really increasing market, which is the Far East and China especially. And Jay Jopling has that all-important conduit in Hong Kong, which does great business for them, the White Cube in Hong Kong.
I mean, do you think when you're the scale of a Damien Hirst, I mean, do you need an agent anymore?
Well, I always felt that Damien Hirst's best gallerist was Frank Dunphy, who was his old Irish, very wily old Irish business manager, who was the guy that negotiated him the 60-40 terms with the White Cube Gallery, which is pretty much unheard, and with Gagosian, I understand, which is pretty much unheard of. And so I feel that, you know, I feel that he doesn't. I mean, he obviously bought in 2008, 2 days before the financial markets crashed, or a day before the financial markets crashed, and Lehman Brothers disappeared. There was that famous sale at Sotheby's where he bypassed, you know, both of his New York and his London gallery, and you know, managed to sell £280 million worth of art at Sotheby's, which is quite amazing.
Do you think this is also just a natural cycle? I mean, rather than a 7-year itch, just a 17-year itch as well. Is there sort of a precedent for that? You grow apart.
I guess you grow apart, and I think also it's not to underestimate the importance, say, of the secondary market. All of Damien Hirst's most famous and, you know, will be most valuable works have already been made, so they're going to be sold between private individuals, and they're going to be sold at auctions, and not any longer going to be sold in galleries. Other than the stuff that maybe he's, you know, there'll probably be off the back of this the big Damien Hirst retrospective that's going to happen in Qatar in the spring. There will probably be a new show, I'd have thought, of new works in Hong Kong rather than in Hoxton Square, which would obviously have been the sort of heartland of, you know, of the YBAs and Damien Hirst and the White Cube Gallery. That gallery is going to stop in at the end of this month as well. It's going to move west with all the rest of the galleries that sort of grow up and move west.
Do you think there's anything else behind this?
I don't think there's any deep-seated weirdness, but I think that it's definitely the marriage of convenience has kind of run out, and I think both parties are like, we're not really going to make much money out of this anymore. But it's strange to announce it, I think.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, I felt that you might just let it fizzle out. It's quite a funny thing. as you say, the race for the press release, your first question is quite an interesting thing. I kind of wonder why it was needed to be announced at all.
Exactly.
You could have just thought, oh, you go to the Gagosian at Art Basel and you don't see any Hearst on the stand and you just think, okay, well, they didn't choose any this
year.
So it's a strange thing to be very positively like, we've broken up. We've got the tin cans on the back of the Volkswagen like that advert, just divorced.
We have to break up now as well.
Why?
Oh, we do, because we have to go to Tokyo.
Okay. But, I thought you were just going to play the rest of that Judy Garland scene.
Well, I might. I was going to say, well, on top of the trolley, can you make sure, as it's Friday, can you have the bar trolley ready upstairs?
Don't worry.
I'll be up there in about 7.5 minutes.
I will sort you a top up.
Wonderful. Our culture editor, Robert Bowne. You're listening to Midori House, 1853 in London. Now, every Friday afternoon here at Midori House, we'd like to get out and meet our neighbours, whether they're near our headquarters here in London or in our, well, near our bureaus around the world. This week, we visited Winged Wheel, a beautiful stationery shop a stone's throw from our Tokyo bureau. Our Tokyo researcher, Jun Toifuku, met up with the Winged Wheel's Rumi Nagata.
My name is Rumi Nagata of Winged Wheel. Our store is located in Omotesando. The main avenue in Omotesando is called Aoyamadori. Aoyamadori Avenue is famous for Zarukova's trees line. The main avenue of Omotesando is lively with stylish people. It's an upscale shopping area featuring several international brand outlets. If you walk a few blocks away from the main street, you'll find a lot of lovely restaurants, boutiques, and galleries. Omotesando is a part of Tokyo, and our neighbors are Shibuya and Harajuku. In our neighbors, there is a Japanese restaurant called Maisen, and they are specialized in tonkatsu. Tonkatsu is a sort of pork cutlet. Also, there is a unique coffee shop called Omotesando Coffee. They are so nice. In our neighbors, we have Omotesando Hills, which is a big shopping mall. And also we have Spire Hall, a little bit far from here, but just 10 minutes from here. And Spiral Hall is famous for design goods, and you can see a lot of design exhibition there. We are a stationery company which specializes in social stationery, such as high-quality greeting cards and invitations and letterheads. And we opened our store in 2001. We have more than 1,000 kinds of product, which are original items, and exclusively sold in our two stores and on our website. We only have paper items, so there is no fountain pens or other stationery. So it's a kind of paper store. We have two original main types of paper, which are cotton paper and traditional Japanese washi paper. Our contracted paper mill sits at the foot of Mount Fuji, and a plentiful supply of pure mountain water makes soft and beautiful paper. They are all made in Japan. So we are so happy to hear that people say our stores are boutiques rather than stores. A lot of items are displayed in the showcases, and there are some shelves and drawers where customers can feel and touch the texture of any cards they like. This is our original paper, which is made by cotton fibers. And as you can see from the edge, the border line is painted by a craftsman. So we rely heavily on craftsmanship. We produce this cotton paper at the foot of Mount Fuji, and we have a contracted paper mill, so we ask them to produce exclusively to our stores. We have various customers, and there are, for example, they are looking for some wedding invitation cards and party invitations, and some other business stationeries. We have many Japanese customers, as well as tourists and foreign customers.
And that was Meeting the Neighbors at the Wing Wheel. That's all the time we have for today. Our show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager is Sam Impey. And that is all we have time for this entire week. I'm back tomorrow morning. Goodbye.